This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Daniel Orsino. And you're a competitive martial artist, cosplayer, nurse turned fantasy author. So how are you doing today?
Good, how are you? Thank you for having me.
And we've got your link up there that's clickable when we're published. But we're live on the air on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. So if people want to type that manually, go to Birth of the Fae. Dot com, but that will be clickable, so you won't have to worry about remembering to type that. You'll be able to click it after we're off the air. But thank you again for being a guest on the Fam Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing right now?
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So one of the things we like to ask guests before we get into more detail is why do you do what you do, and what motivates you?
I do what I do because it was kind of by accident, to be honest. A patient needed a distraction during IV treatment. We had a conversation, and that turned into me telling him a story. And from there, it took on a life of its own, and I haven't stopped since because I realize I kind of live in my own little world anyway, so I might as well share it with everyone else.
That's interesting. So you've been into like fantasy. I noticed I'm a big comic book fan, and you mentioned Chris Claremont and George Perez. I've been a child of the 70s. People would know the comic books X-Men and New Teen Titans from those two authors. And I'm just wondering, like, what was it about fantasy and comic books that kind of drew you in as a person, as a fan?
Probably the first inclination and the first draw was the old reruns of Batman and Wonder Woman, the Green Hornet. That was my first real introduction to the comic book world. Seeing Yvonne Craig as Batgirl, that kind of blew my mind initially because, I was watching Batman and Robin and then, Catwoman. You're just kind of like, whoa, what's this? Okay. As a little girl, you're like, hold on, this is
What's that?
different. What's happening here? And then Green Hornet, Kato was a totally
Yeah,
new concept to me.
Bruce
Yeah,
Lee,
Bruce Lee was just, because you're going from Robin, who's being captured all the time and needing help, to
yeah,
Kato.
Kato was
And I'm
totally
like,
different.
what's happening here? He drives the car. He never needs a gadget. What happens? Like that was just this moment of it was like that lightning bolt of what's this? And then Linda Carter comes on the scene
Oh
and
yeah,
Wonder
Wonder
Woman
Woman.
runs in and I'm like, okay, now the game has changed. Whoa, back up, hit the brakes. She's rescuing Steve Trevor, and during the day she's his secretary and he has no idea. And she dresses like this, but it was just like, what is this world and how do I get in as quick as possible? So my dad bought me like these Wonder Woman records that I could listen to, which were essentially the comic books, audio comic books, really. And then as I got older, I'm like, I need more of this in my life. And I dove into comic books. And for a while, it was just Wonder Woman because that's all I knew. And then as I got older, I was introduced to, initially the cartoon X-Men, and they did Dark Phoenix Saga better than anybody, from the iteration. And then I read the original material. And I'm like, who is this man that wrote this? Why do I care about the Dark Phoenix? Why do I care about this villain? And that, once again, flipped everything, started reading more, read all of Claremont's stuff. And it just opened my eyes to so much because as a teenager, I'm going back and rereading, obviously it had come out a long time ago, but I didn't know. And then I'm looking at the world a little differently because there were so many metaphors and I didn't know the X-Men were that deep at that point, I'm just like, they're misfits, whatever, they've got powers and this is kind of cool. And then I'm looking at things going, oh, it means this. Oh, it means that. And I took a step back and I'm like, you could write and have it mean this, and nobody's gonna like, you're not gonna get in trouble for it.
It's like the fantasy kind of science fiction world. Like I grew up like watching Rod Serling on the Twilight Zone, and he
Right.
used to make all these comments about social what was going on,
Yes.
but it was in science fiction. So the monsters on Maple Street, you could look at that as it was, but it was a comment on society. And same thing with Gene Roddenberry with Star Trek. He would make these morality tales. And the
Yes.
comic book artist, even going back to like Lee and Kirby, they created like Marvel, they used to have all these kind of morality tales within Spider-Man and then Fantastic Four and the original X-Men.
Exactly.
They were outcast. The mutants, the idea was like they were kind of like what Rod Serling was doing. They were making
Right.
through science fiction, you could make comments. You could have like duality or dual layers or all kinds of symbolism, which is, did that get you into writing? Is that what made you like, whoa, I can use writing to say what I want to say?
As reading these as a younger person, I thought that was awesome. I didn't think I could do it. I just really thought this is an awesome thing to do. And I thought it was a great way to teach and open people's eyes. I never thought I personally would do it. You know, I had my heart set on doing other things, but I was so enamored by it. My dad used to make us watch the old Star Trek. So I was kind of always in this world. I mean, the first movie I ever saw was the original Star Wars. My dad would take us down to a drive-through, you know, every Friday because he just thought the special effects, like he was into all that. So it was always there. The culture was always in me. You know, I always say it kind of ran through my veins from day one, you know, the Muppets, Star Wars. We were always watching the old reruns of Star Trek. I watched In Search of with Leonard Nimoy. This stuff was there from day one.
Just,
it was like somebody was weaving it in, saying, you know, one day you're going to do this. And I had no idea. So
it's in your
the
subconscious.
Psyche was there.
It's in your subconscious. Yeah, it's just back
it was
there.
Being buried in.
Yeah.
I didn't know. You know, I thought I was going to be doing other things. I never knew I'd end up here. But it was definitely on its way, kind of developing. And just laying the foundation. But I was always writing short stories as a kid and all that. And they always wound up the sci-fi fantasy going in that direction. But I thought everybody did that. Just like I thought everybody narrated their life like JD from Scrubs. I thought everybody walked around like, you know, their own little narration. And when I saw Scrubs, I went, oh, yeah, see, we all do that. Like, to me, that was just, don't we all walk around like that with theme songs and doing that? I really did think everybody did this. So I think in a way I was always going to wind up here. It's just, I took the long way to grandma's house.
But so like you were inspired by all this, you got into cosplay, but you were into fantasy and science fiction and comic books, and then you were kind of acting it out. And so like when you came up with your character of Faye, maybe you can talk about like what, I think you mentioned that you had this like incident where like you were with a patient and it kind of triggered you to come up with this. Is that how the character came up with, or is that something prior to that?
No, that's, I was talking to a patient and it, I was not reading Faye. I didn't know anything about them. Like I only knew about Tinkerbell and things like that. It wasn't anything that I was into. So I had no idea at all. I was simply talking to a patient as a nurse, trying to get him to stay put in his IV chair. That's all I was doing. And as we were talking, he mentioned he was recruited by the CIA out of college. And I'm like, oh, we could have found out what was in Roswell. Like I was just going down my usual conspiracy rabbit hole, like just kind of joking because, you know, like I said, I watched In Search of. That was my thing, my jam. So as we were discussing it, he was like, no, it was for the Trends and Intentions division, like a very boring division. And he was explaining the process and why he didn't take it. From there, I went down because I'm not breaking HIPAA. He was being treated for Lyme disease. So there's a whole conspiracy around that. We jumped onto that. And for some reason, and to this day, people think I'm BSing. I don't know why this came out of my mouth, but I said, well, you know where Lyme really came from. And he goes, oh, Plum Island. And again, we went down that and I went, no. For some reason, out of my mouth came the Fae. Like I said, I have no idea why. And he went, well, who are they? And so I started telling this story. And I said, well, you know, they're angels who got locked out of heaven. You know, there's two sides. There's one side that were the foot soldiers of the archangels. And then there was another side that were getting the earth ready. And he was like, what? And I just started making this story up. And then I'm like, but then a CIA agent who's really here undercover. And he's like, undercover. I'm like, yeah, you're here in this little Lyme disease clinic to see if that fey human hybrid nurse is in on all this. And then he kind of leaned back and he realized like I was putting him in the story and I'm just making this up off the top of my head. And he's like, oh yeah. And I'm just like blurting this out and it's just coming to me and I'm like, sure, I'll go with it. Not thinking anything. Yeah. I'm just like, whatever.
Kind of riffing.
Yeah, I was just like, eh, whatever. You know, once again, just narration off the top of my head. I'm not thinking anything. And so I'm telling him this story. I have no names for characters. I'm just whatever. And then he's like, tell me more tomorrow when I see you. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So the next day we talk again. And I would tell him another chapter off the top of my head. And it was just like a campfire thing. That's kind of how I thought of it. And as we kept going, things would happen in the IV room and I would add to it. So if the doctor had this big black Labrador, so when the dog would walk in, I'd be like, oh yes, the Dark Fae King had a black dragon and this is what happened. And he would be like,
wow,
okay,
so it's a
cool.
Real stream of consciousness. Stream of consciousness. They kind of like muse. Like I'm a big fan of art that's kind of done point in time, you know, like a lot of jazz. A lot of like, you know, experimental music is kind of done riffing. You know, you kind of take the moment, you take what's going on, you kind of creatively, you know, invent it. And I find that things can be really vital because there's a lot of stuff in your subconscious. Like you said, you had already been like all this stuff that was going on in your head because you read this stuff, you watched this stuff, you heard this stuff. And so there's a lot of stuff that your mind starts just making connections if you're creative. It's kind of like that muse that the poets talked about. That I think creative people, we can tap into it and we can take all this stuff and we can turn it into something. And that's kind of our talent. Like you're in that space.
Right. I think that's really what it was. And that's why I say, I think the foundation was being laid all those years ago. I just had no idea. And that's my joke. I took the long way to grandma's house. It was always there. I had no idea. And so I would just tell stories. And then he kept saying, you need to go home and write this down. And I'm like, I'm going to physician assistant school. My applications are in. I'm going to shoot some faces up with Restylane and Botox. Like, this is the path I'm on. I have no interest. And the universe had another plan. And he was really one of my biggest cheerleaders of go home and write this down. I'm telling you. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. And eventually, you know, circumstances came and that's what I wound up doing. And it turned into what I have now are 6 novels, a novella. The second novella comes out June 1st. And then I go to volume 2, which is Birth of a Succubus, which is the story I actually told him about the CIA agent, the hybrid, you know, hybrid in the Lyme disease clinic. That's the story. And so it's just turned into this world. And who would have thought? And in volume 2, there's a lot of nerdy little comic book Easter eggs. The nurse is a comic book geek who finds herself thrown into this world. And it's kind of the same little story of me.
So how long did it take from actually having that conversation to you actually writing it down?
It took us a while. It took me a long time because I was determined to resist. And I was going through the PA school cycle, CASPA, which, you know, you have to wait for the applications to open and go through the school interviews. So I was still doing that. And it took me months to kind of sit down and then finally start. And when I did, I hand wrote everything because once again, I didn't know what I was doing. So I would just pick up a journal and be like, okay. And I'd start writing. Then I go, oh, they're going to want to know this. Pick up another journal and start writing. And it wasn't like, oh, chapter one. It's nothing like that. I just started going and then I'd go back. So if you look at it, and I have all the journals, if you look at none of them are in order. Like it's just pages of whatever. And then I'd have to sit down and sit at the computer and start going, this should be chapter
what goes
one.
With what? Yeah, then you start piecing it together.
It was jigsaw puzzle.
So from all that, like you had, like it was a conversation and then you became in journals and then you had to take it and put it in the computer. When you were starting to put it in the computer, were you actually intending to turn it into a book? Or were you just trying to work out? You were.
Yes. I was at that point like, okay, I'm going to make this book. Like now it's official. But initially I was going to do what will be Birth of a Succubus. That was the original story. I was just going to do the story I told him, like just on the, you know, just completely about the CIA agent, the nurse. And then it turned into what became volume one, which was the backstory of the Fae and how they got here and how they took the moniker Fae. That turned into volume one because I'm like, oh, people are going to want to know how, why they're here, what happened. And it just all started flowing and everything. So it was totally not planned. And I always joked I was going to pull a Star Wars and release like volume two first and then go back, kind of pull episode four and then
go backwards.
Phantom Menace.
You go backwards, yeah.
But I wound up going volume one first, and now I actually pulled it and I'm going to re-release it later after volume two because I wanted to kind of make some adjustments. And now I'm going to pull the Star Wars where I'm releasing volume two and pulling volume one. So I'm going to do my original plan because that was always my gut. And what I've learned through this process is always trust your gut. Mm-hmm. Always trust your gut, regardless of what the experts say. Go with your gut. So I'm doing that now, but it was just a crazy process in general and learning more about myself. And I had gotten into the PA program. And once again, the universe threw a bunch of blockades and it was like, they were saying, this might be what you want, but it's not what the universe wants. As I got into the school, got into my program and was like, yep, this is what I'm doing. And I was like, it was like a salmon swimming upstream. And I was like, but I'm going to get there. The universe was like, aren't you sweet? That's so cute. You think that? No. And it just kept hitting me back down until finally I went, I relent. I give up. What do you want? And the books were there.
Now, how did martial arts like help with that? Is it the discipline of martial arts that helped you kind of stick with it? Or is it other aspects of martial arts that help you with writing?
I think martial arts was so ingrained because I can't say I started young because most people start martial arts at 5 now. I started at 18, but I think what helped was movement in general. I videotape, I take my phone and I tape all of the fight scenes before I write them. So I can actually see what it is. And I also realize what I'm good at and what I'm not. I don't have sweeping battle scenes, riding horses and charging into battle like Lord of the Rings, because I don't ride horses and I don't know what it's like to fight 1,000 people. So you don't get those in mind. You know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Now I don't know what it's like to ride a dragon either, but I can imagine that a little bit better. My fight scenes are very condensed. You know, I can set the camera up. I could set the phone up and fight two people and figure out, what angle should I tell the story from? Do I want it to be from the person attacking or being attacked? Or should it be just from over the shoulder? After watching so many, you know, superhero movies, I hate when it's just a cape and the top of a cowl and just a fist. And you're just like, what happened? I can't see. Yeah. I like to be able to be like, this is what's happening. I can see it all. So martial art helped in that so much because I could be like, all right, this kick wouldn't be realistic. This punch isn't realistic. They're not going through the wall because nobody here is superpowered. Or yes, if you hit them with the fist, you're going to sit there and go, ow, that hurt, right afterwards, whatever it is. Or an elbow is going to be better so they're not injured afterwards. So all of that helped. And then looking at the fight scene afterwards and saying, no, you know what? It's going to be better if I tell the story over the person's shoulder so they're seeing it happen. Whatever. Mm-hmm. So that helped tremendously. The only time it didn't help was I have a novella called Fire, Ice, Acid, and Heart, which is dragon tournaments. It's these big dragon tournaments. And I realized I don't know how a dragon fights. Like, I have no idea. So I wound up buying these little dragon action figures from Michaels and like sitting there and going, okay.
Working it out.
Yeah, like flying down. And I made tinfoil balls because the Fae in it throw plasma balls and I'm throwing it like at each other and trying to figure out how would you fall? Like, how do you hit? What does it feel like? Because I know what it feels like to get hit by a front thrust kick or by a round kick. I know those. I know which way my body goes. I know when I go forward, when I go back. I don't know what a plasma ball feels like. So it's kind of weird to figure out the fantasy aspect.
Yeah.
And the real, I know what a punch feels like. So, you know, there's a lot of helpful things. And then there's times where you're like, I've no idea. I have to like make it up or figure out what would the impact be and work backwards.
But also, like, I guess reading comic books might help too, because a lot of the fight scenes and the graphic novel, like storyboards, like
yes.
If you look at those X-Men comic books or even the cartoons, you get a good example. Like, there's all this fantasy, like Dark Phoenix is shooting out power bolts, you know, like these, like a lot of superheroes have these fantasy capabilities of what that could be, like a dragon throwing fire, you know, because they can throw these like energy bolts. And so
yes,
I think that once that's in your head, then you have like in the back of your mind, like, well, I've seen this kind of, you know, this kind of application of this kind of fantasy adventure. And you could, you know, you're kind of inspired by it and pick your own vision for it, right?
It definitely helps, but then martial arts, the logical side gets in the way. Because now after taking it for so long, you've been told what won't work and you're sitting here going, okay, and you're trying to balance out the fantasy side versus the realistic side. So that's where it's like, it's a help and it's a hindrance at the same time, because you know the beauty of a butterfly kick, but it's just not practical. And then you're watching, I believe it was Captain America. It might've been Civil War. Maybe it was a second. I'm not sure. It might've been Civil War. I'm not.
Winter
one
Soldier.
Of the first, the
Winter
second
Soldier,
ones.
Yeah.
Where George St. Pierre is fighting on the carrier at night. And it's George St. Pierre, and it's actually, and it's Captain America. And George St. Pierre like throws a, it's Age of Ultron. He throws a butterfly kick in the middle of the fight. And I'm like, nobody throws a butterfly kick in the middle of a fight. It never lands. It's just a pretty kick. So that's where it's like.
It just looks visual. Yeah. Some things are just visual.
Dude.
Yeah, I mean, because it's like fantasy and some like special effects in Star Wars, people do things like that's probably not like, you know, it's a Jedi move. You know, but that's probably not based in reality, but like you can do it.
That,
you know, but
exactly. That's one of those moments where you're like, stop. Like the realistic martial arts side of me is going, cut it out. This is just for fun.
Yeah,
that's when I'm like, so I've tried to make my fight scenes as realistic as possible so you can gather everything, but to try to explain a butterfly kick in words, it's very difficult. And then there's also that side of me going, nobody gotta throw that, come on.
Yeah, well, it's like there's a lot of suspension of disbelief, and then you're trying to do things like, well, you know, Bruce Lee, if you follow Bruce Lee or Jackie Chan, you could see what could really be done, right? Like, those guys could really push it, and he's like, well, I can stay within the limits of what I can see Jackie Chan or Bruce Lee or any of those great martial art movies you watch in the 70s or in the 80s. He's like, okay, well, Drunken Master 3, I can see some crazy moves, but you know, that I could go that far because you could actually do that. Well, he could do it, Jackie could do it, but so in the research you do for your book, I guess it's like, are you pulling from the fantasy and the comic books and the movies, or do you actually go to the library and look up other things?
For the research aspect, I do actually do the research for Thine Eyes of Mercy, which was my second book. It takes place in, you know, in between like Tudor London, Tudor England, like that kind of time frame. I actually took a class on Tudor etiquette because I wanted to make sure, you know, watching the Tudors is not going to do it for you. So I wanted to make sure that it was realistic as possible. So I did take a whole class on Tudor etiquette. So in certain scenes when they're eating, it was as close to realistic as possible. And I went and learned as much about Queen Mary as I could, Queen Mary the First, because a lot of stuff is done on King Henry VIII, Anne Boleyn, but Queen Mary got a little lost and I didn't want to rely on stereotype for her. So I went
so
and
you
did
to
a
get
lot of
real,
research
real,
on
good,
her.
Good research, yeah.
Yes, I did like real historical research. The first manuscript was written, all of the scenes in that was written in Old English, and my editor threw it out. She was like, nobody can read this. She's like, I'll give you a thy of the pretty, She's like, and that's all you're getting because this is, and I'm like, but it's so realistic. And she's like, no, it's not. And I'm like, and I was trying to make it so authentic. And, you know, because you're in that stage in the first couple books where you're trying to prove yourself as an author. And she's like, it
Yeah.
really, but I, you know, I went through the maps of the castles, what they would have really looked like during that time, furniture, tapestries. And I exhausted myself because I realized as long as you're getting it close, nobody really can, like, they just want to be immersed. They're not,
immersed.
They don't really care. So my dragons, on the other hand, months and months and months of research to develop my dragons. Proud of my dragons. They took me forever. I worked with a mechanical engineer, a physics professor. I worked with a veterinarian because I wanted my dragons to be plausible. I don't want Neil Grassi Tyson, whatever his name is, coming after me and being
You're
like,
saying that's not realistic.
Yeah. I, if I was ever on Mythbusters, I wanted to be like, they're plausible. That's it. Like, you know, they're not 747. They're not that big. They're not the size of that, but their oral defenses all came from the digestive system and we built outward. So we worked on bacteria, you know, exactly the anatomy, physiology inside, then went outside. We did that for the flying, how they fly. They, you know, they don't take off like Superman. They jump and glide to the eye membranes when they take off, when they glide. They have eye membranes to keep debris out. Like, I went
all out. You did a lot of details.
Yeah. We went crazy on the dragon. Probably went a little too crazy. So that stuff was clear because they are, my fae are angels who were kind of in between the war between the creator and Lucifer. There was a lot of research done because there's alternative history. That was all I went and researched.
Now, do you find with like the modern audience compared to like if you like an audience in the 60s and the 70s is probably more willing to kind of dive into, you know, the attention span deficit today? Because like a lot of people are living with these like 30 second, 50, you know, 90 second like social media. So if you're a writer, if you're somebody in the 60s and the 70s, like you could probably depend that you're audience would not be distracted by all these modern things. And so they would dive into your work. Do you have to kind of like understand like the where the audience is today in terms of their attention span and what kind of grabs them versus like, you know, their older, you know, the way it used to be?
I definitely had to learn that. I originally, when I wrote the first book, it was a combination. It was books 1, 2, and 3 put together. It was a big book. Like too big. And my developmental editor, Cleet Barrett Smith, kind of pulled me aside and he was like, D, let's talk. Walk with me down the street for a second. He's like, come take a walk. He's like, I think it's great. Are you as a new author going to hold an audience through this book, through a 600, 700 page book? Probably not. And he's like, no one is going to take that leap of faith on a new author. He said, they're not going to spend the money on that. And when he said spend the money, that's what caught me more than the attention span. Because I sat back and thought, I have to acknowledge this is somebody's hard-earned money. I appreciate you spending it. I don't want you spending $30, $40 on a book where you're like, meh, I don't want that. So at that point, I went, chop them all. And he went, oh, I'm saying cut it in half. I'm like, no, thirds. Because I would rather you take the chance on one book and, you know, make it small. So you're like, okay, I'll jump in, like toe dip in and go from there. So I cut all the books and I made it. Book one became Locked Out of Heaven, which was much smaller. And then that book became 3 because I acknowledge people have to spend the money. You know, I'm not giving it away for free. We're not, you know, we all got to make money. Yeah. That's what we're doing here. So I cut it all down. And at that point, I'm like, you're spending your money to take this journey with me. That's an honor. And these authors that are acting like they're giving you something and you need to be proud of it is BS. The fact that you're spending your money on me, I'm bowing down to you. Like, holy cow, you want to buy my book? We need to make this an experience. I want to give you a beautiful book inside and out and make it so special. So I make it the gateway drug into the fantasy world. I take these books down to between 200, maybe 225, 250 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And some people are like, oh, is it worth it? I'm like, it is, because I would rather you give something that you can binge, because that's the Netflix way now, and be able to put one to two books out a year than George R. R. Martin you, and you're like waiting 10 years and you're like, are they dead? Are they alive?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, yeah, you're
quality out.
Also, if you keep it short enough, then you can kind of extend it into the next book, and you draw people into a series. Where I think if you do the 700 page, 800 page, trying to be like Tolkien, like it's not 1972. People aren't probably going to they're not going to read that. You know, even the Tolkien books, like how many people are actually reading those? You know, people go back to them because they're classic, but. Like the attention span today is like you're not going to be able to put out a Tolkien as the first book. And maybe once you get an audience, maybe you could be, but even then you probably don't want to do that because people don't have the attention span to do that, right? To get into that.
Everybody's day is busy. I don't want to make you feel like you're hijacked. Like you want to go to bed. You know what I mean? Maybe you have the end of the day to read. I don't want to make you feel like, I got to finish it. I want you to want to finish it, but not feel like you have to finish. You know, finish there's a difference in that. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to feel like a chore. I want you to be like, yeah, I can binge it, whatever. But I know in 6 months, she's coming out with another one. So I almost want to drag it out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I think it's a respect for the reader.
Yeah, you gotta respect their time and the money, like you said. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was wondering, like you mentioned, like, you know, making, changing it, but like, what were some of the mistakes you have made as an author that you can kind of relate to other authors that maybe you didn't realize, but now you've like lessons learned?
Oh my gosh. I could probably do a whole show on just mistakes. The first edition of Locked Out of Heaven was put out by another publisher. And I trusted them to edit. Huge mistake. Authors, here's the deal. When you edit, the first set of edits only catch 80% of the mistakes. That's it. So it needs to go through editing several times. I did the first edits with an editor, gave it to the publisher, and they were like, we're going to put it through two more. Well, they did. They said they did. They did not. So there were mistakes. We don't read it. Anybody who says, any author who's like, of course I read my book. No, we don't. We've read it 500 times. The mind self corrects. So there were mistakes. It crushed me. But it's like a yearbook picture. There you are, blue frosted, eyeshadow and pink frosted lipstick and a perm. You can't change it. That's where you were at that time. So I've learned,
get an editor,
and get more editors until it's perfect. Yeah. There's always going to be a mistake. You can't help it, but you don't want several. That was the first thing. Go with your gut. Number two, I had wanted a prologue in the first edition. It was denied. In the second edition, it made it, and I was so happy. The other thing is get a contract, but get an IP lawyer to look at the contract.
Mm-hmm.
I've left my second publisher, and I didn't have an IP lawyer look at it. I should have had an IP lawyer look at it. And remember, business is business. Don't care how nice they are. Your publisher could be the nicest person in the world to your face. It don't matter. At the end of the day, the publisher will always look out for them. They are not looking out for you. Don't care how nice they are. They're never looking out for the author. Because the bottom you pay their bills.
Yeah. Well, you got to watch it. Well, like all artists, like if you think about musicians, like it's a known history that our master rights and our like publishing rights and, licensing rights is a big problem. Because like if you're an artist and you just, I got my advance, but then you realize like they actually took the film rights, They took the merchandising rights, so they can put the t-shirts and the cups and the toys, and you don't get anything. So if you don't pay attention to that, like intellectual property rights, as any kind of artist, then you find out that, like, you know, they're selling it to all these advertisers, and you're not getting any of that money.
Well, the thing is with publishers is sometimes they'll give you those rights, and you're thinking, oh, I'm doing so great. They're giving me those rights. Read a little deeper into the royalty statements, because sometimes you can audit all you want. You're still not getting the truth. That's the first thing. And those little royalty statements, the cut, even if it's 60, 40, 50, whatever the cut is, by the time it gets to you, there's all these added costs that they don't have to be transparent about. They'll tell you they're being transparent. Yeah. They love telling you that. But it's their overhead. That's all deducted. So it's not as clean cut. And unfortunately, laws have not yet caught up to the publishing industry. The music industry is being a little more exposed. The publishing industry has not yet. So I don't care how nice they are to you. The funny thing is, even when they offer you
a lawyer,
a way out, the minute you get a lawyer, all of a sudden, all bets are off. And you're just protecting yourself, as they've told you many times to do. You know, they'll lecture you about it. Mm-hmm. You're a celebrity. Make sure you protect yourself. The minute you take their advice, the lines are drawn and you're out. So my biggest advice to you, always get an editor. Always. Even if the publisher gives you an editor, go get your own. Because quality control is not what you think. Lawyer up. Don't care how nice they are. Lawyer up and always look out for yourself, because it's your name and it's your work. So you only will be the one who cares about it. They'll tell you they care and it's cute. They don't. It's you. Look out for you.
What about like your cover? I've talked to authors where some people kind of give up the rights of like how the project's going to be presented and what's going to be on the cover. Can you talk about like how you, you know, maintain the vision for the cover or the whole process?
I did not get that. What happened was, when I was signed by my second publisher, I went in with a whole idea that was thrown out, and they wound up putting me on the cover, which at first sounded like a great idea. It was not my idea. They saw a picture of me in cosplay as one of the characters and said, give us 24 hours, we've got an idea. They came back and said, here you are. This is going to be our plan. We're going to put you on all the covers. Oh, that sounds great, until I have to pay for the photo shoots, the costumes, and everything. I do not get reimbursed. So all those covers that had me on the cover, one of them right here, here's another one. This was me in cosplay. I had to pay for all of those covers. Wow. I had to pay all the photo shoots, make all the costumes. Great. Wonderful. Okay, I'll do it, because I'm now being branded as the cosplay girl. Cool. I'll do it. No fantasy author has ever been on the cover. Great. We'll do this. Awesome. I do all of this. I make it onto the Tamron Hall show. It's phenomenal. A month later, they tell me, we're changing your covers. Sorry, excuse me, what? Back up, huh? I have no say in it. They have now gone alt typeset. I'm like, what? What do you mean? We're taking you off the covers. We're just going to go with typeset, because that's the trend.
He decided that was the trend.
I have just spent thousands. I have made all these costumes. I have now branded myself as this. I've gotten on a national talk show, which is going to go into syndication and play this several times, who have shown all my covers.
And then they change it.
And you're taking me off. And I have no say.
Yeah.
So some places give you no say. Some places say they give you say. It's very hard. The most you can do is you can ask. But at the end of the day, unless you're self-publishing or going with a hybrid.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
It's harder to control.
The only thing I can tell you, do have a professional. Make sure whatever it is, your covers look professional. There's some great cover designers out there. You know, check the trends, check what your competition is doing, and kind of build from there. It's really, you never know. you really never know what's going to happen with the covers, especially if you're being published, you know, traditionally.
Now, in terms of rights, like movie rights, film rights, like audio book rights, are you involved in, trying to pitch this to turn it into like movies and TV and things like that, films?
Audiobook rights I do own, because before I signed with my second publisher, I had already gone to Skyboat Media and had done Locked Out of Heaven. After that, my former publisher had said, "Oh, we'll stick with them. Cool." They wound up screwing up that relationship. They did two more audiobooks. I did not like them, and they were pulled. I have not done another audiobook since, but I can, and I probably will go back to Skyboat because I loved what they did so much with Locked Out of Heaven. And I would like to continue to do the rest of the books, but since I'm reorganizing it, I will wait. But I love doing it. As for TV series or animation, is really where I'd like to go with the first series. I'm completely involved in doing it. I've been approached before, and I'm still being approached to doing something. My former publisher had nothing to do with it. Those were rights I maintained. And I would like to do animation for volume one because it lends itself more to an anime than anything else.
Yeah,
There
because they
is,
can actually visually stay
yes,
true to
visually it just
what you want. You
works.
want to be heavily involved with the director to get the feel.
I've written a script. A script has been written that I wrote. It's placed in a couple screenwriting competitions, so it was my first shot out. But like I said, I've been approached by a couple people, interested in it. It goes somewhere and then it kind of falls. But we always get to a certain point, and I just entered the Dallas International Film Festival with the script, and they wound up drawing the first scene and sent it to me, and I was like totally blown away. And it's so cool, and I'm probably going to post it because it's just amazing to see your first the scene of your first script sketched out. And you're like
That's pretty cool.
storyboarded. You're just like,
Storyboarded out, yeah.
oh my God. And they did anime style and it's so cool. And that I was just like,
I mean,
that
there's a
made me
big,
go.
the anime market is so big, a lot of people love that. I mean, I lived in Tokyo and I was amazed by how, the manga and anime, adults were so into it. And now it's like the whole world is kind of like that. I was in 2004 in Tokyo, and I was kind of like, that's the way it was. That's the way it is. But now people, all around the world have accepted that, yeah, that's a modern form.
Right.
That you can put, your ideas into, that you can have,
Yes.
fancy novels and get not just a film, but you could turn it into like an anime
I think a
series.
series is kind of where I want to go with it, an animated series. I'd love to make it a graphic novel. I am working with this with somebody right now, an editor, to make it into a graphic novel because
Oh, that's
I
another
just
cool thing.
think that's kind of where once again, where it goes. That was always my original idea I had. While I was writing it, I thought this lends itself to a graphic novel. So
That's a
more
whole
work.
different audience. You have the Comic Cons, you have the fancy cons, you have the cosplay. So there's a lot of marketing that you can take advantage of. Like if you get into that venue, you can go to the Comic Con conventions. You could, maybe a keynote speaker or have a presentation. It's just another way to kind of spread the idea out
I go
and
to GalaxyCon as it is right now. I go with
That's
on the
cool.
pop-up bookshop with my partner, CR Rice, and we have, where we bring indie authors there. But and I've been asked, I've actually had other comic book artists who have read the book say, "You're turning this into a graphic novel, right?" Like they're just kind of like, "This is where you should have gone." And I'm like, "Yeah." At the time, I'm looking for an illustrator. I have somebody that I'm talking to right now who's a phenomenal illustrator. I couldn't believe he even took my email. I was kind of like, "You'll talk to me?" It was one of those moments where
That's
I'm like,
cool.
"Really?" So
You never
I'm
know. You could
hoping.
try.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it was one of
You never
those.
do.
You never know. And I had a couple publishers that were interested, and they were like, "Yeah," but it was always like I didn't have an illustrator. But they were like, "When you get this going, come talk to us." So I've always wanted to be in that format, and I think animation is set for volume one. Volume two had people interested in a live action. There was a Bible written. There's a first script out, a pilot script out there. So it's just a matter of the whole thing catching.
Yeah,
We
you got to
have
catch
kind of,
fire. get it on the
we're right
train.
there. It's like we break the surface for a second, then we go back under. We break the surface, we go back under. That's kind of always where we've been. And part of that is we haven't found, we find the right audience. The audience I have is very, very loyal. And I love them to death. My readers, I just think are, you know, I think every artist says that. They're like, their fan base is the best. My readers are. I just want to introduce it to more. Being on blasphemy lists doesn't help. But, you know, you work it out. And you just kind of keep going from there. And that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things I like to ask about is, like three things about yourself that maybe your audience doesn't know. I always ask people I've interviewed that maybe there's three things you can kind of bring up that maybe your audience or fans wouldn't know about you that you think are interesting, that they maybe should know about you.
I'm a Loch Ness Monster fanatic. I actually have news alerts on my phone every time Nessie's been spotted. I have to jump in on that. I love the Loch Ness Monster. For all my craziness and things I believe in, I'm not a reincarnation person. And people always send me articles because of all the mystical stuff I have in my books. They're like, do you believe? And I'm like, that's the one thing that I can't get on board with. And I have an obsession with gumballs. I have bags of gumballs all over my house. And I only chew them for so long and I spit them, and then I get another one and I can run through a bag of gumballs in like 3 days. I just have to, when I'm writing, I need to have gumballs. It's just one of those things. It's my vice.
So one of the things I also wanted to talk about is just the whole, well, you talked about the blasphemy list and you mentioned it, and maybe we can explain to people what that is, because I don't think if everybody maybe doesn't know what that is.
A blasphemy list is when you are labeled an enemy of religion. In this case, it's Christianity, Catholicism. I think Catholicism is one of them, and a Christian ethics group put me on it for them, you know, but it's just one of those things where, like I said, you're an enemy of that specific religion, and they blast it out to people. For me, it settles down and then comes back up. Right now it's back up again, and I don't know why, but I'm getting emails now from another group where the email starts out in English. And it's usually a biblical passage or scripture of some kind. Then it goes to Italian, and it finally ends in Latin, where that is an exorcism chant. And now they're putting dates. I'm not sure what the dates mean, but it goes into my Google Calendar. They want me to put it in there. Once again, no, I don't know if this means they're showing up. I don't know if that's the date I'm supposed to be exercised. I'm not exactly sure. We haven't figured it out yet. But those come once a week, sometimes twice a week, and they come right in a row. Like if I block it, another one comes and another one comes. Those are fun. That started 3 weeks ago. Yeah, about 3 weeks ago. I first got on it for the first edition of Locked Out of Heaven, where my first publisher put me in Christian fiction by accident and then kept me there because they thought all publicity was good publicity. They did. Go well.
Oh,
and it's built the marketing ever since.
Point. Yeah,
and then I got back on it for some reason last summer. I was rediscovered. I was not in Christian fiction, and the Guns of God got me. And then they started sending pictures of them holding a gun, like a hand holding a gun with like a date underneath it. Once again, lots of fun. And then I'd get emails or DMs like, we want your home address because we don't like your relationship with God. So can we send you pamphlets? And at that point, I started answering, you know, fun ways like, Lucifer hasn't told me what realm of hell we're going to live in once we're married. I'll let you know, but for now we're registered at Bed Bath Beyond. Please send towels. You know, things like that.
Yeah, you play off of it.
I've got to be, you know, the major problem they had and like I said, they're still on book one. They haven't even gotten a book four yet. But the problem is because I've rewritten some of the lore of angels and the fact that, which once again, it's a fantasy book.
You're a writer.
I've used a biblical event about a certain sea being divided. They're upset because it is
you
no
challenge
longer
a canon, yeah. You
a
challenge
god
it.
Event. I have it that the Fae are responsible.
Oh,
They
so
that the
they can't
humans
stand that.
come into a battle between the Fae. So the parting of it is not God. It is one of the Fae Queen creates a water spout to stop the battle. So the humans interpret it as their God has answered them and they're able to cross, and it's and she leaves it as that. But in reality, it's a Fae battle. That didn't go over very well. And so people
so
took
interesting.
It as a blasphemous thing that I wrote.
But it's fantasy. I mean, it's like, okay, you're not saying this is nonfiction. It's like, you're not saying this is like a new Bible. So it's
I'm
like,
not saying
this
this
is not,
happened.
Yeah, this is like, you know, it's like if I create this on another planet, you wouldn't like, are you good? It's like, I don't understand. But I mean, that people take things and the haters come and the haters go, but like art is art. And, you know, artists aren't going to stay within the confines of some box, right? Because, like, if you're an artist, you kind of are thinking out the box, right? So it's
that's
not going to
how I
fall
took
into
it.
the – that's the way it is.
I didn't – like, when I wrote it, I did not think it was going to be a big deal, like, at all. I was just like, oh, this is cool. It's alternative history. This is so cool. Literally, Kindle, match, fire. Like, had no idea it was going to go this way. I tried apologizing. I actually did an interview, like, apologizing and saying, I'm so sorry. No offense was meant. I respect religions. That made it 10 times worse. And then I realized, just stop apologizing because that's not getting me anywhere.
Yeah,
and then book four, I just decided, you poke the bear long enough, we're going in. And I just went in head first. That's why I joke. I'm like, you guys are all still mad about book one.
Wait till you get four.
I'm like, there's a chapter called The Jesus Factor. I went in hard because I'm like, you want to keep going? We can now play. Because if I'm getting the hate for a sin I didn't commit, let's go.
Yeah, I mean, it's like rock and roll. I mean, rock
let's
and roll.
Play now.
Was, well, all the rock and rollers were condemned, you know, back in the 50s. Like, oh, we're going, you know. Elvis, they came after Elvis. I mean, they came after all of them. It's like, come on. It's like, it's music. Like,
I'm
like,
done.
It's not gospel. It's not gospel music. If you want the gospel, listen to that. Like, if it's rock, it's rock. And like, if it's fantasy or it's science fiction, that's what it is. I didn't say it was historical, but
that's,
you know,
what I said. I'm like, I never said this was, you know, but they were mad because after this is witnessed, the Fae Queen, who was an angel at one point, decide she's going to follow this group of people who crossed the sea and make sure they're okay. And she decides, like, she could turn them away from whatever this new religion is. And I use a passage from the Bible that happened, and he speaks to them, and she has a visceral reaction because that's her creator. And she's like, well, why is she talking to these humans and he won't talk to me? And people are just like, oh my God. I mean, it's just a whole. And I was like, I have no idea what the firestorm is. It's a book. This is a joke. Like, it's fantasy. It's not real. But it created a firestorm. And like I said,
so
every
it's
now
real
and then
to
it
some
reignites.
People, Well, I think it's like, you know, artists are, we're going to be artists, and we, you don't, I think you just have to, you know, get beyond it. It's like anything you create. I was like, once you create something, there's always going to be somebody that says they have an opinion about it.
Yes.
And I think a lot of times as artists, it's like, I can't go and change my work for based on everybody's opinion.
Right.
Like,
I can't.
I'm going to put it, it's there, it's what it is, and I create the next thing. You know, and I think it's about being confident. You know, eventually, like a lot of times we don't always have the confidence, but like a lot of times the crowd's going to go want this and they're going to want that. You know, it's like, if I create the work because there are people that like the work and I like the work, right? So I think as an artist, you go the direction that your art is, you know, driving you toward. And so if your art, your muse is pointing you this way, that's the way you're going to go. Right? So
that's exactly it. I'm going to write how I want to write. If you like it, great. Jump into my world. If you don't like it, you don't have to read it.
Yeah. That's always been the thing. People forget. I mean, they tried to burn the Beatles stuff because Lennon made a mistake of saying they were bigger than, you know. So,
Yeah.
like, they happens. Like, people forget. Like, some people probably forgot that because they would, oh, everybody
Right.
loves the Beatles. Not everybody loved the Beatles,
Not
but not
everybody loved
everybody
them.
did.
Not everybody
So,
loved them, but it happens.
yeah, it happens. But I want to thank you again for being on the show. It always goes by quicker than we ever think. I want people to remember that we have birthofthefae.com up and that will be clickable. Now, if people go to birthofthefae.com, what do they find there? Like, if they
They'll
click on
find
that.
the series and the order that it's in. They'll find information about me. We'll be revamping the site shortly to get ready for the novella. The novella pre-order should be up in March. It's called At the Heart of War, Danius and Jaden, which is one of my fan favorite characters, Lady Danius, who is the Warden of the Butterflies. And these are her love letters between her and her love, General Jaden, who was one of the first female generals of the Fey army, and she has passed. And in the memorial, Danius is given the last of her belongings, which is a quiver, and inside are her letters. And so Danius puts them together and realizes over the past couple of months there's been clues to what has really transpired. So she has to deal with her grief and now finds out that maybe the heroic sacrifice for Jaden's death wasn't all that it seems. And so now she has a mystery to solve at the end. And has to figure out how to get rid of her grief, how to deal with it, and now what really is the mystery be behind Jaden's death, and where this will lead the Fae. So it ties up loose ends from the entire series, and leads into a little bit for book two or for volume two. So there's a lot to it, but Lady Danius has been a fan favorite from the day that she was introduced, which was book five. She's actually the Butterfly Warden who's on the cover. And people have been asking for her love story. So this is what I finally give the fans. They've been asking me for it. So Danius and Jaden comes out June 1st. Pre-order link will be up probably in March. And it's a love novel. It's my first romanticy. So here we go. I'm trying a
Oh,
love
that's
story
awesome.
out.
Well, I want people to make sure that every time we have an interview, we do have the link of the guest, and we do encourage people to click that. They are clickable. We are on all the major podcast platforms. Those later today, whatever platform you like to listen to or watch podcast on, you'll be able to click through on that. And I do appreciate you being a guest on the Fan Electric Ghost podcast. I wish you a good rest of the day, and thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you, everybody who's watching, listening, and soon to be watching and listening. And you can always also find me on Instagram at Birth of the Fae and check
Thank
out
you. Have
there
a
for
good
all the
day.
upcoming Fae news.
Oh, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much.